Hi, this is Bob Wells here, and welcome to Undercurrent Stories. This is the show where we hear about people's interests and uncover some fascinating stories at the same time. I hope you enjoy today's show. Hi, this is Bob here, and welcome to another episode of Undercurrent Stories. Today's guest is Stuart Hill, former Lieutenant Colonel in the British Army. On the 4th of July in 2009, Stuart led 160 men in a close combat fight against the Taliban in some of the fierce fighting seen by UK forces in Afghanistan. 8 hours later, medics battled to save his life after shrapnel from an IED tore into his brain. Not surprisingly, he returned a different man, but incredibly, he has converted his experience into a catalyst for new possibilities and a fascination with how we can use our brains more effectively in the workplace or in our personal lives, which he talks about through motivational speaking, and his mantra, making lives better. He suggests that living in the moment and exercising mindfulness, acknowledging, accepting, and parking negative thoughts is the most efficient way to do this. I have to say that in the course of this conversation, like me, you will be forgiven for concluding that Stuart's eloquence and ease of talking about his subject equates to a full recovery. However, as the conversation developed and I learned more about a severe brain injury, the battle to overcome the injury is a constant for Stuart, which he faces with courage and is a lesson for us all. At the end of the conversation, Stuart and I were conscious that there were many other subjects that we wanted to discuss, such as mental health, resilience and neuroplasticity. And this will make up the basis for another conversation that I look forward to in the near future. Hello and welcome to the show, Stuart.
Hi, good morning, Bob. Thanks for the invitation.
That's great. I think we sort of were introduced through a mutual acquaintance, Duncan Barker.
Yes, I don't really know Duncan. He was in the audience at a talk that I gave a few years ago, and he got in touch. And we communicate every now and again, where I give my sort of any guidance I can or whatever. And so and then he just said, "Look, get hold of Bob or have a chat with Bob."
It certainly left an impression on him, hence the conversation today. Yeah. So thank you very much for coming on the show. It's great to have you on. Before we talk about your motivational speaking and making lives better, just as a bit of background, could you just tell us a bit about yourself, your life journey, you know, what it was like growing up as a child and how you decided to have a career in the army?
So I was born in Germany. I was born in West Berlin. My dad was in the army. But that is not the reason why I joined the army, or at least I don't think. But so my dad was in the army. I was a PADS brat, so I moved around for the first sort of probably 14 years. Yeah, 14 years of my life, moved every couple of years. And I just loved being in that sort of army community, that gated community, because you felt very safe as a child because you were very secure. That, you know, there were guards, there were fences of security, and so you could pretty much just be a proper child and not have to worry about anything and just run around in woods and play. And it was great. And I loved it. Then my dad joined as a private soldier, went through the ranks, left as a captain after, I think, 23, 24 years, and decided for some bizarre reason to move to Wales, to West Wales, because he's originally from Sussex. My mum's from Glasgow, but they decided to move to Pembrokeshire and West Wales. So I moved there when I was 14. And it was a shock to the system because I remember waking up on the first morning on the top of this, halfway up this small mountain in the village of Menachlogdi, and I opened the curtains and all I could see were about five houses in the distance. And it was a shock, and it took me a while to get over that. So I lived in Wales from the age of 14. This may come up later, but when I was about 10 or 11, I wanted to be an actor. Then I wanted to be an artist. So when I was at school, my favorite subject was art. And I thought, yes, I want to be an artist. I'm going to be a painter. But for whatever reason, they didn't have art at A level in my school. So I dropped it.
Yeah.
And then I actually didn't go. And I just lost the passion for it. I lost the, I'd say lost the passion for painting. And then school took over, life took over, the expectations of others took over. So I did the A-levels that I enjoyed, which was maths, history and economics. And I remember sitting with a careers advisor who said, "What are you going to do, Stu?" And I said, "Well, don't know. I wanted to be a painter, but now I'm doing these three A-levels." And he said, "Oh, you need to be a banker, or you need to go into banking or become an accountant." So I thought, okay, we're fine. My grades were okay, but in that time, so I was accepted to a poly, not to a university. I went to a poly to study business and then dropped out after a year. I just was not inspired whatsoever by business, by accountancy, by finance. And that showed in my very poor attendance. There is a reason I'm saying this. So I dropped out after a year.
Yep.
So I'm now sort of 19, 20, not sure what to do. So I'm unemployed for a while. I'm working at a local leisure center where I was working initially as a student. I worked in Tesco, thought I wanted to go into retail management. And I spent about 2-3 years just not knowing what I actually wanted to do. And then it was through that time that I thought, well, come on, what did you enjoy doing as being, you know, as when you were a child? Yes, I wanted to be an actor and a painter, but I had dismissed those. But I thought, I love the army. I love that environment. I love being outdoors and that robust nature of it and uniform. And then I thought about my dad and what the career that he loved. And so decided to see if I could be good enough to join the army. So did the regular commissions board because I wanted to be an officer. I wanted to lead. I knew early on I wanted to have to manage and to lead individuals and people. So yes. I applied, got in, went to Sandhurst in 1994 and then joined my local infantry regiment. I wanted to be in the infantry. So we're the people that sort of carry everything. We live and breathe out of our rucksack. And so I joined my local regiment, the Royal Regiment of Wales the end of 94. And that was it.
And that was your journey. So were you mentioned there about the outdoors, you know, you like the army life and the outdoors. Were you sort of quite into sport as well?
I was, but never to, I mean, I loved rugby.
Yeah.
But I actually didn't play rugby properly, or when I say properly, we didn't, when I was moving around as an army brat, we didn't actually have rugby in the school. It was all football. And so I sort of picked up a rugby ball for the first time when I was 14. And by that time, when, you know, being in a Welsh school, there were a lot of very good, capable rugby players.
Yes.
And I gradually learned and, you know, I was moved from, because of my height, I'm 6'4". But I was really skinny then, so I started off. Actually, I was quite fast. So I started off with the wing, then the centre, then I became a flanker, and then I was put into second row, which I hated. But I stayed in the forwards end from there on in.
Yeah.
So sport, yeah, just loved outdoors, but never excelled. I was always probably good rather than great, and I just love being dirty. I love being pushed, being in hardship, you know, and particularly in the sort of deepest, darkest West Wales, where, you know, the nearest bus was 3 miles away. So I'd have to walk to catch a bus. And there's only one or two buses a day to, you know, it's just everything. It was just sort of harder work in deepest, darkest Wales. And I think, you know, that built me into the sort of the person that I am.
So probably you like the challenge and it built up resilience, I guess.
Yes, it did. Yeah. I think, you know, what is resilience? Resilience is built around our experiences. And so my experiences of, I suppose, not knowing what I wanted to do, disillusionment, failure. I say failure because, you know, I didn't complete my business study degree. I was unemployed for a while. I felt dejected, thought, you know, just didn't know what to do. And then I found something. I found my métier, and this is so important. You know, this the métier, this perfect vocation where I can utilize my strengths and my weaknesses, you know, because it's not just about strengths. And I found it in the army. It was a perfect fit for me.
And so when you joined the army, you immediately thought, yeah, this is it. This is what I want to do.
This is it. This is it. Even being shouted at, even being told very unpleasant things, and I won't say the word because it's the worst swear word you can think of. Yeah. I had to one day shout that to myself and tell me that's what I am, because I had messed up on the parade square. But all of that, I loved being at Sandhurst. Although I was under pressure, I felt a bit of an outsider, actually, because the majority of people, probably I would say certainly over 75%, maybe in the high 80s, were public school educated and yeah. graduates. And there I was. I was a non-graduate from a state school, and there were very few of us there. And so that in itself was a challenge. Yes. And I think I carried for a long time, the cliche of the imposter syndrome.
Yeah, and it's interesting that 2 points there. One is the métier, which I'd like to go back to. But the imposter syndrome, the more people I talk to, and everybody seems to say, yeah, I get a bit of imposter syndrome. It's like we all get it, I think.
I think we do, because it's in the human nature to be to be attracted to the negatives. What is it? Negative is like Velcro. Positive thoughts and emotions is like I forgot what is it, the slippery thing. I can't. Anyway, let's just call it slippery thing.
Yeah, and I love what you were saying there about métier. I love that word, a professional occupation that you really find you want to do. I think there are a lot of youngsters, myself included, when you get to the end of the school, and you sort of think, what do I want to do? I don't know. I'd like to be a rock star. I'd like to be a footballer, train driver, whatever. But you know, in your heart of hearts, you've got to make a living. And I think that bit's quite difficult. And you also mentioned there about you felt a sense of failure, whereas, you know, because you dropped out. But you then sort of say, well, at 18 or 19, is that a failure or is it just you finding your way? It's interesting.
This is it. And so, when I want to give advice to younger people now, and pretty much so many people are younger than me, I'm 52. But I did it with my eldest daughter and my 12-year-old daughter now, is to say, look, just follow what's in your heart. Yes, have a backup, but think about it, you know, but actually, what is it that is driving you through your heart? What is your passion? Where are your strengths? Follow that. Don't fight against the grain of just trying to be something that perhaps you're not a natural fit for. And so for business, for me, yes, I loved it at A level. I loved doing maths and economics, but actually that wasn't truly in my heart. No. And when it became more of a challenge, I did not want to persevere through that challenge and through that weakness, because it just became harder, and I just couldn't be bothered with that.
So you joined the army. So we're talking mid 1990s, are we? When you
95. January 95 is when I turned up to Northern Ireland as a very young, well, I was 22, as a young platoon commander, and straight away I'm given, I have the honour and the privilege of being given a platoon of 26 soldiers of ages from 18 up to 30, probably 30, with a variety of experience, from a year's experience to 12, 15 years experience, and suddenly I'm in charge of these people, and I've got to inspire them and lead them after 1 year of training. And
so after 12 months, you go straight out and you are responsible for 30 men?
Yes, as a platoon commander.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did that feel?
It did feel scary at the time. But what I'd learned from Sandhurst as well, and this is something that I'd learned. You know, I didn't find the perfect way to lead straight away. Perfect is too strong a word, but I didn't find my style of leadership immediately when I was at Sandhurst, and it evolved and changed. And then by the end of it, from the natural feedback that I was getting from the other cadets. And what I knew in my heart then was it's about the leadership is about people. It is about inspiring people. It's about making them feel that they're valued, that they matter. And so when I went in that actually this isn't about me. Leadership is not about the leader. It's about the honor and the privilege of who you've got to lead.
Yeah.
And never forget that. And so I was like, okay. I'm going to, and I told them the truth, and I did this throughout my whole leadership career, is just tell the truth and tell them your thoughts, tell them your own ambitions and aspirations, tell them what you, your values are, what you want from them, what you expect from them, but also what you expect from yourself. And so I just spoke to them honestly, and I said, guys, you know, I am, because it was a male only environment, platoon. Yeah. I said, this is my background. This is where I'm from. This is my experience. This is where I'm lacking experience. This is where I'm going to be looking to you for advice and guidance, because I've had a years of training, but here in this room, there is, I don't know, 30 years of experience. I'm not going to dismiss that. I'm going to use it, and together we can grow. And if you focus, I think as a leader, if you focus all your efforts downwards of bringing people up, getting them the best opportunity you can to help them grow and help them promote and surpass you if needed. Yes. You as a leader will thrive in that. And you will also, I think, be just noticed by everyone else around you. And it's infectious.
Yeah. And that noticing obviously took place fairly quickly, did it?
I mean, as I said, it seemed to be a meta. It seemed to be a good fit for me, and I led fairly well, and so followed a good career. Was a platoon commander, trained at an infantry training center for a year. Was a recce platoon commander. Did a year out in Canada, armored warfare instructor. I attempted SAS selection, got through the hills, which is incredibly hard, got through officers week, which is where the majority of officers fail, went to the jungle in Brunei, and that is the hardest environment I have ever worked in. Yeah. And at the end of the jungle, 9/11 happened whilst we were out there, and got back, and the CEO of the SAS said, look, Stu, we don't have time to bring you up to speed. We are just about to go to Afghan. You know, 9/11's happened. This is what's, you know, we are going straight into war and we can't risk you. And so they said, no thanks, which hurt me and hit me hard. And I was then disillusioned for a while. I lost my purpose, and I'll probably mention a few times, but I'd lost my purpose and my reason for being in the army, and was sort of distracted for a couple of years, forgot my place in the army and forgot what I was about. And then towards, 2007, I received, so I've been in for 15 years now, received a posting order to say that I was going to take over as a company commander of B Company 2 Mercian, so about 100, anywhere between 120 and 160, 70 soldiers.
Yes.
And I would have been doing two tours in Afghan in my two-year appointment, so 2007 and 2009, and I loved it. My wife didn't.
I can imagine.
Like, woohoo, 2 years of, you know, at least a year on operations and all the training and deployment and pre-training. So yeah. My wife and daughter, the first daughter at that time, who was seven, said, actually, we don't want to move with you to Belfast, because the unit were based in Belfast. So we bought our first house.
Yes.
Locally around sort of the Nottingham area, because that's where I was working at the time in the army. And then I did what was the best 2 years of my life. And then I got blown up.
Well, we'll talk about that a bit later, but I'm interested. I mean, for a lot of us in Civvy Street, we've got no idea what a war would be like and what it's like to be experiencing it. I mean, I suppose Saving Private Ryan might have been a bit of a good sort of example of what it must have been like on D-Day, but I'm sure it doesn't actually signify what it is actually like. I mean, can you just describe, first of all, what you felt like as you sort of travelled over to Afghanistan and with the, you know, the thoughts of what could happen? And then can you tell a little bit for listeners about what it's actually like in a combat zone, please?
So I was excited. I was looking forward to going to war. And that sounds probably the wrong way of saying looking forward. I was excited. I was intrigued by it. I wanted to go to war. And you find that with a lot of people within the military. And this is not because we want to fight and we want to kill people and we want to experience. It's the way I explain it is, it's because the majority of the time in your military career, you don't go to war. That's the reality, apart from recently with sort of Afghan and Iraq. But the majority of time, you're training for and preparing for operations. And so it's a bit like if you were an actor and you had created this play, and you had trained for this play for years and years and years, and you know, you perfected your role within this play, but you actually never had the opportunity to go on stage and perform in front of a live audience. That is what it felt like going to war. Yeah. This is my opportunity. This is my chance. This is where I'm going to know if I can really lead. This is where I know if I am a good officer in the heat of battle,
yeah,
when the pressure is really on you, when training, yes, it helps a huge amount, but when those bullets are, you know, they're not blanks, they're not real, you know, so when these bullets are hitting the bank around you and are going past, and you know, when you hear the bullet, the sound of the bullet, that means it's already actually gone past you.
Hmm.
And so you will never hear the bullet that will kill you.
And what does it sound like as it comes past you then?
It's like a... It's like, yeah, this... Just this... And it just...
Yeah.
Bang, 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 bang. And just not just the noise of the receiving of the bullets, just but the sheer ferocity and the intensity and the volume of us firing weapons towards the enemy.
Yeah.
It's such an overload, or a sensory overload. It's just incredible. And that first time it happened, it's like, whew, this is it. I don't know whether it was 10 seconds or 1 second, a nanosecond, but I thought, shit, this is real.
Yeah.
This is happening. And that was on my first, I smile about it. My first operation then, when we got out to Afghanistan in 2007, actually I took over B Company. They'd already been out there for 3 months. So I joined halfway through the tour. So I was arriving as a sort of brand new company commander, and I didn't know anyone, and I had to lead these people into war, or continue to lead them into war. And that was a challenge, because I remember that as I arrived, my company sergeant major, who's like the, I suppose, the equivalent of my second in command and foreman, or yes, the union rep.
Yeah.
After the outgoing commander had left that I took over from, we had an hour handover takeover, and then he flew away in a helicopter. One of the first things Sergeant Major Jason Peach says to me is, says, "Sir, I've got to tell you the truth. We don't want you here."
So, oh, really? Oh,
okay. this is going to be an interesting challenge. Anyway.
Why was that? What reason did he give for that then?
Because they had been out there for 3 months already.
Right.
They had worked with their Simon Butt, who was the outgoing company commander. They'd, yes, worked with him for 2 years. They knew him for, yes, his faults and his strengths, like anyone. They had worked out there for 3 months, but more importantly, they were becoming scared.
Right.
They had the first soldier had just been killed the week before. They had the B company, the two men, they had been through some really, really intense hard fighting. And so the first soldier had just been killed. They'd had some serious injuries, almost hand to hand fighting to take this place called Rahim Calais, which is where I arrived to. And they were battle weary and scared. And they said, the sergeant major said to me, "Look, we're worried that you just want to go out and win a medal and win a gallant, you know, be a typical officer and win a VC or something."
Yeah.
And so they were worried that I would I would fight just for the reason of fighting.
Yes.
And so I had to speak to, you know, I didn't have to, but I did. I spoke to them, and again, you just told them the truth again. Pretty much very similar to my first meeting with soldiers, where I just said, "Look, this is what I'm about. This is, yeah, the values. This is what I want to achieve. This is about the mission, not the medal. I don't care about the medal. This is about our mission." So I said to them, "Look, guys, when I do my mission analysis, and I'm going to use you for this, I'm going to get your advice and your views on my, you know, my own thoughts, considerations. If I conclude at the end of this that we will, to achieve the mission, we don't need to fight again for the next 4 months, then we won't fight. However, if I determine that we need to fight every single day, then believe me, we will fight every single day.
Yes.
And so that's what I told them. I told them the truth, and I lived by that. I lived by my values and my actions. So this is, you know, coherent, what I call coherent leadership. I spoke, and then I followed it through with action. So when I said I would involve them in my planning, I did. And that hadn't happened before with them.
No. And did you find they responded to that initial talk quite well?
Very. And it all depended on the, well, the, overall they did.
Yeah.
I was starting to build up a culture of honesty, of transparency, but of responsibility, of what? Of co-independence, mutual support, of belief in each other, of everyone is a leader, everyone has a view. I mean, as I said to some of the soldiers, look, guys, you've been out here, you've been fighting for 4 months. I've done 2 weeks of training prior to coming, that's all I had, 2 weeks of training prior to coming out here. And yes, I've been in the army for 15 years, but I've never worked in Afghan. I've never been to battle. Tell me what you know. And I would, you know, I'd listen to them. I would dismiss some of it, but I would take some of these little nuggets every now and again. But also depending on their own experience, you know, some private soldiers who knew themselves, who were lacking confidence perhaps, or had never actually engaged and spoken to my, you know, a company commander in the same way that I was trying to get them. They would sometimes say, well, no, sir, it's up to you. You know, you're the boss.
Yeah.
I don't want to think about it. I'll just do what. But at different levels, I spoke to them and they thrived on it, honestly.
Yeah.
I could see it working.
I can see parallels there with industry, having been in an industry where you're the boss and they sort of say, well, you're the boss, you should know. And you say, well, what would you do?
Yeah.
You know, what are your thoughts? What are your experiences? And it was the same when people would come up with a problem. You know, well, what are, you just go back and you say, what are the options? Get them to almost come up with their own solution.
Yeah, and that is a very annoying saying in the army. And it's one of the things you learned when you go into an office, the answer from the officer at whatever level is, Don't bring me problems, bring me solutions.
That's it.
I don't want to hear problems. And so that became a get out clause for anyone, you know. I haven't got time for it. Just bring me a solution.
Tell me a solution, yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, it's Bob here. Just a quick interlude. Hope you're enjoying this episode. And if you would like to hear more interesting interviews, we have over 80 episodes to date with many fascinating guests talking about a wide variety of topics, which include music, history, philosophy, fitness, food and drink, adventure, contemporary culture, and many, many more. I'm sure there's something that you'd really enjoy. So all you need to do is just visit undercurrentstories.com or search Undercurrent Stories in any of the podcast platforms. And now back to the show. Tell us a bit about you're obviously higher up, that they decide they're going to do some fighting somewhere, and then they come to you and say, right, you need to lead these men. Obviously there's planning involved and everything.
Yeah.
Tell us about that bit, because I guess sometimes when you're, I don't know whether you're, how it works, are you told that you've got to go and do this, or these are the options? How does it actually work from higher above?
Right, this is where I won't be entirely accurate with the sort of terminology and the correct wording, but because of my brain injury, which I'll talk about later, but it's so you pretty much receive a mission.
Yes.
Everything is mission directed. Everything is a mission statement. So it's, you know, I want you to achieve this in order that we can have this effect.
Yeah.
So it's an overarching, whatever level you're working at and whatever, whether it's strategic, operational, tactical levels, is this is what I want you to achieve for this reason. These are the parameters I'm going to give you, whether that's time, whether that's resource, whether it's legal, whatever it is, but you have to work within these constraints, but you've also got this flexibility. Crack on. And then, you know, come up with your own plan and back brief me. You know, as a commander, you then ask for back briefs. Okay, you've got the parameters, you've got what I want you to achieve and why. You go and decide how you're going to do it, and then just back brief me on what it is that your plan is going to be, so that I'm aware of it.
So, for example, I mean, I'm just thinking on the cuff here, but it could be something like: there's two villages here. We know that
the Taliban are in there. We want you to clear it out and make it safe for us to go forward. Is that the sort of thing?
It could be. It could be like that. Yeah. So in the military, they like to use a lot of verbs in the sort of the mission statement. So deny, disrupt, deter, destroy. You know, they're all military related terms, but it's sort of warfare terms. So it won't be as prescriptive perhaps as saying, I want you to go into that village and kill the Taliban there or do whatever it is. I want you to destroy, deny, deter enemy influence within this area of operations.
Yes.
And this is what you've got available for you to do that. And so that could, you know, they could, this is something I'd, when I was on Officers Week and SAS Selection, where they give you real life examples. They don't give you names or anything, but you know, this is proven examples of what they, some operations that they gave or so that they did. And this is saying, you know, they said, okay, this are all the, just because you, sorry, these are all the weapons you've got. And they intentionally, and John, there is a reason I'm saying this, they intentionally in Officers Week, they give you loads. They give you pretty much anything and everything in the hope then that you actually go, yeah, I've got a sweet, this is my toy shop. Yeah, I'm going to use everything. And but sometimes you don't even need to use any weapons.
Right.
Yeah. It's what is the effect that I need to achieve? And so this goes back to, if I have to fight every single day to achieve the mission, then we will. If we don't have to fight, you know, could it be, okay, so let's say I've got to not destroy the enemy. I've got to deter the enemy or deny the enemy this particular area. Could one option be that I actually just go and ask for a meeting with the head Taliban and say, listen, I'd like you to leave. If you don't, we're going to destroy you or whatever it is. Could that be an option? Does it always have to be the first sort of, I suppose, the more automatic obvious, the clear, you know, we always must go in and fight them. I mean, the majority of times we did. I never actually approached. You could sometimes mediate through local leaders and try and influence the local leaders that you knew would be talking to the Taliban or would be under pressure from the Taliban to tell them everything that happened in the meeting.
Did you ever meet the Taliban directly?
Only at the end of a rifle or at the end of an aircraft.
Yeah.
Or at the, or they would, you know, be giving me a present by shooting at me or blowing us up or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
Yes.
It's scary, but this is the key thing, I think, one of the key aspects of any leadership and for life is to be calm, always be calm when making decisions. And it's something I saw at Santos. So when I was at Santos, when you're on the radio, you're on the radio a lot because you've got people either 100 meters away or 10 kilometers away or whatever it is. So a lot of communication is through radio. And in the middle of a firefight, whether it's training or in reality, it's intense and it's hard, it's loud and it's confusing and you're under a lot of pressure. And there is I saw at Santos and throughout my career, individuals and hear them start to panic and because the noise is getting louder, I need to start shouting and I need to, and so they're following the energy that has been created by war. And then you saw it just filters down to everyone. And actually when you're under that pressure, when you're putting yourself under that pressure by becoming really animated and perhaps frightened and you know, flapping or whatever it is, you can't make clear decisions.
No.
So you have to slow yourself down. You have to calm yourself down. So I've discovered, actually, whenever I'm going to be on the radio, whenever I'm in the middle of a firefight, whether that's training or operations, is I'm going to speak at a low, quiet level and breathe.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to breathe. And I'm going to take a couple of seconds to breathe before I speak to anyone. And in that moment, calmed down the stress, it calmed down the brain, it allowed the blood and the oxygen and the information to flow through to the cognitive part of my brain, because I wasn't constrained by my fear and my emotions. I was free to think to the best of my ability. And so whenever you're under stress, whether it's personal stress at home, whether it's in work, but certainly in work, it's certainly in front of people when you're making decisions. If you're feeling stressed, just calm it down. Just breathe. Breathe through your nose. Just say to yourself. And so I had this mantra that I used a lot, which was decision and action, calmness in crisis. And I would say to myself, Stu, just calm it down. Calm it down. Calm it. And by saying that to myself internally, it may sometimes out loud. Yeah. So calm it down, calm it down. That slowed everything down, slowed my heart rate down, slowed my breathing down, slowed the pulse, you know, it allowed me to think better. And then I would say, right, now make a decision, because I knew I had the information and the knowledge and the experience to be able to make decisions.
But you couldn't let your emotions dictate.
And I did not want to let confusion and stress and emotion dictate. And sometimes particularly when you've got a soldier, one of your men, I say men because I had majority of mine were men, one of my soldiers has been severely injured or killed, the natural of reaction is that you want to bloody kill that person who's done that. You want to pay them back. And if you do that, then we become like, I don't know, we just become like, you lose yourself. It's so easy then to work outside of the rules of engagement and the law, because you're now focused on killing and death rather than focused on doing your job. And going back to your mission statement, what is my mission? What do I need to do here? What is the overarching thing here? But one way.
When you were out there, how closely were you working with the Americans and other countries?
I was working at the tactical level, which is the sort of that direct war fighting level. And we weren't doing integrated work at that level unless there was an area of expertise that we needed. So, for example, air support. So a lot of the pilots, it was multinational.
Yes.
Because apart from the Americans, every other country is limited in the resources that they've got available for them. So multinational aircraft, multinational pilots, a lot of the drones, the larger drones, because drones at that time in 2007 and 2009 were fairly basic, apart from the odd one or two. So again, reliant on allies for that. So the bigger, more expensive stuff, more the sort of operational strategic stuff, it's much more joint and relying on each other. At the tactical level, I didn't. We had the Americans took over from us, US Marines took over from us in 2007. And that was interesting. different standards of leadership and fighting, but I won't necessarily go into that.
No,
I won't.
No.
The higher you went up, the more and more integrated it was. So you have, the sort of liaison officers at the brigade level. So what is that? That's the brigade was the biggest, largest for the British, the largest fighting component out there. So that's about, anywhere between 4,000 and 6,000 soldiers. Pretty much everyone who was fighting was at sort of that brigade level.
You were leading 120 men. Was that throughout the whole experience in Afghanistan?
So
the same guys.
Yeah, no, 2007 had 120 odd. Sometimes it went down to 80 with if there was a combination of leave and injuries and life, just other tasks and responsibilities. Soldiers would have to disappear off a lot. And then in 2009, probably on average about 130, and then it went up to 160, had 164. For what was the largest offensive operation ever to have taken place by British forces in Afghanistan, which was Operation Panther's Claw. So I had lots of attachments, psychological operations team. I had human intelligence teams, improvised explosive disposal teams. So had all of these other attachments that I wouldn't have on a day-to-day basis with my company. And so Operation Panther's Claw started on the 3rd of July, and then I'm leaving theatre dying on the 4th of July.
I know it must be a sensitive subject, but can you just tell us a bit about that experience, what you were doing before and how you remember it, Stuart?
Operation Panther's Claw. We were, my company were doing well out there. We had a good reputation. And so we were chosen as what was called the lead effort. So the lead company. So we were the spear tip of this battle. And so therefore we had all the sort of the resources, additional resources attached to me, to my company to achieve this. And we had to clear an area, I think about 5K per day. So 5,000 meters per day, expected to encounter about 350 Taliban fighters. And so we had to clear this area. Although the operation started on the 3rd, we physically started ours on the 4th, which is when we crossed our line of departure. So the line of departure is a line on the map which shows the line when you move over from friendly forces, territory and influence and control over to enemy territory and influence and control. So the Nadi Ali Canal, which is a canal in Helmand near a place called Babaji, that was a line of departure. And I remember crossing that. I will never forget that fateful 4th of July day when I lost my independence because a couple of hours after crossing that line of departure, there's an eruption of machine gun fire, yet another eruption of machine gun fire and several loud explosions because it'd been fighting all day. But this time I hear over my radio earpiece the screams of my soldiers who have been injured as opposed to giving commands and orders. And then I hear a voice from Lieutenant Guy Disney, who is he's 27 and he's a troop commander. So he's been attached to, he's got a light armored vehicle, which is attached to my company for this. I'd met him about 6 days before. I remember him vividly still saying, Zero Alpha, 20 Alpha, contact, casualties, I need a heli. I think I've lost my leg. Over. So Taliban had ambushed his vehicle, machine guns, rocket-propelled grenades, and an RPG round. So a rocket-propelled grenade will send a molten copper slug pellet, which travels through the air at about 300 meters per second. And one of these penetrated Guy's vehicle, went straight through his right leg and sort of ripped it off. And he was still trying to command and control what was happening with his right leg having been ripped off.
Cool.
He didn't last much longer before he passed out. But then that RPG round then smashed into the chest of Private Robbie Laws, who was 18, who had only joined my company 6 weeks before. I'd only met him once because he came and had an interview and then he went off to his platoon and he's killed. So my thoughts and responsibility in line with the mission is now to control this, to evacuate these casualties. There are some other minor casualties as well. And so my last memory of Afghan is watching the Chinook helicopter and hearing the waka 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 sounds of the helicopter carrying away my dead and injured soldiers, and that's flying away to my right over the tree line. And that's my last memory. What I don't remember is Lance Corporal David Dennis, who was attached to my company as well. I'd never actually met him. He'd joined us that day, I think, or the day before. He stood on an improvised explosive device that was near the area that I had sighted my tactical headquarters, in an area that we had cleared with our own metal detectors. But by that time, IEDs were of low or even no metal content, so we couldn't actually detect them. Right. So our equipment wasn't good enough to detect IEDs. And there was an IED there that we hadn't detect, and he stood on it and it killed him. The force of the blast, it just There's a thing they call pink mist. I'm not saying this happened to Lance Corporal Dennis, but it has happened to many soldiers. They call it pink mist. What is pink mist? Pink mist is a term that is used by the military or by the soldiers, infantry soldiers, when someone gets so blown up, their whole body just evaporates and it's just mist. It's a pink mist. Lance Corporal David Dennis, he lost all his limbs and his body was found about 40 minutes later. He was just alive, barely alive, but then died on the helicopter, I've been told. But the force of the blast, it wiped out my tactical headquarters. It knocked my sergeant major over unconscious, my forward air controller unconscious, my radio signaler unconscious. The shockwave from the blast smashed through both of my eardrums, and I was knocked unconscious because shrapnel from my radio and also from the blast smashed through the back of my brain. Through my skull, through my brain, with two pieces then stopping a millimeter from my brainstem, which is still in there because it's too dangerous to take them out. So I'm not aware of any of this, and I'm not aware. So I have pre-trauma amnesia and post-traumatic amnesia. So I only vaguely remember the sort of about 3.5 weeks later. So I'm in a coma, evacuated to Camp Bastion, then to Camp Kandahar, then back to the UK for surgery because it's too dangerous to operate on me in theatre in Afghan. My wife received a phone call to say Stuart's been injured, head injury. We don't know any more than that. We don't think he's going to survive the flight. The plane had to land twice, apparently, to alleviate the pressure on my brain. But then I get into the hospital in Birmingham. My wife is there to meet me. She said at the time she was very shocked because I was tanned, having been out in Afghan for 3 months.
Yeah.
I was not an ounce of fat on me. I looked, apart from, you know, from the neck down, I looked, I'll say, like Adonis. Well, I had a six pack I was proud of.
Yeah.
But from the head up, I was just wrapped in bandages.
Yeah.
And so there was, and so then she was told, look, we don't know if he's going to survive the surgery. And then she was then told later, a few hours later, that he survived the surgery, but we got no idea what he's going to be like when he comes out of his coma. And then when he came out of his coma, she was told, we don't know what he's going to be like for the rest of his life.
Crikey.
Because of his brain injury. Let me just say, though, because it's important, everything else carried on. I had now left. So I was now evacuated. My company, so, you know, the whole of the my tactical headquarters, the four or five most influential, important people on that operation for my company had all been knocked out unconscious.
Wow.
Or were coming around. And they had all departed then on various helicopters. And so now the second 15, the second 11 had to step up in war and they had to carry on. Although they didn't actually carry on for the next, I think they gave themselves rest for about 8 hours before they then had to carry on the fight. And then, a friend of mine who happened to be in a brigade headquarters gets a phone call to say, Simon, I know you were supposed to be leaving your job in 10 days. No, in fact, in 4 days' time or whatever it was, because he was due to leave Afghan. He said, right, you're not leaving now. You're taking over from Stuart. He's been severely injured. He might be dead, we don't know, but you're now taking over from him and you're going to be leading the battle, leading his company for the next 2 weeks. Huge, massive disruption.
Yeah.
And everyone had to carry on. I saw a photo, you know, my platoon commander, you know, I've learned that my soldiers did like me and they were proud to work with me. And I've been told, they're the most important person in their company, as in because I was the company commander and I could influence things the most, had just been possibly killed. And I remember my platoon commanders telling me later, that's when real fear hit them because they knew then it could happen to any of them.
Yeah, and I guess for a soldier, the longer they're in battle, you know, in terms of weeks or months, they must come to a point where they think probability-wise, you know, it's increasing.
I mean the next day then Simon, who took over from me a few hours later after taking over from me, he's He's now looking at the body of Lance Corporal Dane Nelson, who's just been blown up and killed in front of him. That takes some leadership to continue at all levels to continue fighting. So going back to your comment about death and injury, could be anywhere. It could literally be anywhere, because they're putting IEDs in trees, on animals, digging it into ground, under bridges, anywhere that they thought you might walk or go past, could be a potential IED. And if you allowed yourself to think about the threat, you wouldn't want to take another step forward.
No.
You had to dismiss it. You had to, otherwise you just wouldn't have been able to operate. Then when you're in that firefight, you resort back to your survival instincts, fear, but your training just takes over and your adrenaline gets such a boost that you deal with it. Afterwards, there is a huge relief.
Yes.
Even if, very sadly, some of your soldiers have been killed.
Yeah. Well, most of us don't experience that type of experience, I have to say. Certainly not in war. So the road to recovery, I mean, it's been a tremendous road to recovery with what you're doing now and what it's led to. But when did you first realise what had happened and actually, I need to get myself better? Tell us about the recovery, Stuart.
It's not as simple as you've just described. Having a brain injury, traumatic brain injury, is one of the most debilitating, confusing, depressing injuries one could ever have. Because, if we think the brain controls everything we do, doesn't it? It controls our thoughts, everything about us. And when that is severely damaged, everything that you knew and experienced and could predict became unpredictable. So the shrapnel went through the back of my brain, but the force of the blast smashed my brain around inside the confines of my skull. So there was severe damage all over my brain, but particularly to my frontal lobes. And this is the irony, is that the frontal lobes is a part of the brain that the central executive, so our executive function skills are mostly processed through our frontal lobes. So planning and organizing, problem solving, goal maintenance, goal selection, perseverance, motivation, so much of that is carried, processed through the frontal lobes. And that's where my bloody damages and my disability is. So the conundrum of having a TBI, a traumatic brain injury, the struggle is that the way to improve is by having to plan and organize and make goals, but they are the very same things that I have a disability in. But also self-awareness, you lose your, because if you think, yes, I knew I'd got blown up. Yes, I knew my head was, I was in a lot of pain. Yes, I was confused. But I thought that, anyone would be if you'd just been blown up. I had no idea that my brain was working differently.
Yeah.
And because no one, you don't get a signal saying, you don't know how to make a cup of tea, or you're struggling with knowing how to tie your shoelaces up. You're thinking, oh, it's because I'm being blown up and I'm a bit confused, it'll get better. No, the pathways that were responsible for allowing you to know how to tie your shoelaces up and make a cup of tea, they've been destroyed.
Yeah.
So actually, you don't know why you can't make a cup of tea. You've got all of the history and the memory of knowing how to make a cup of tea, but why can't I do it? I don't know what to do. And so it's right back to the basics. I had to learn how to dress myself again, learn how to tie up my shoelaces, make a cup of tea. Making a cup of tea for a couple of years was so very stressful. I couldn't, and it's all compounded because it's not working, but I don't know why it's not working, because there's no flags, there's no prosthetics, there's no labels that I can say, oh, that's because, out of your 80 billion neurons, it's because number 265,000 billion, whatever, that's the one that's being damaged. Ah, so therefore that's the problem. No one in the whole world, in the medical community, can tell you what your problems are. Exactly.
For example, on the cup of tea, did you have any support? Did anybody sort of help you?
A lot of things is going back to basics. It's about making goals. It's about whether I'm trying to plan and build HS2 or whether I'm learning to make a cup of tea. It's all the same process. Yeah. It's all, what's the start point? What's the finish point? What is the big goal? How can I break it down into achievable tasks that I can do? And if I can't, who can I ask for support? How can I deal with this? How can I deal with this emotionally? So it literally is a case of, I am thirsty. Now I've got to make a decision. That in itself was problematic. Okay, do I want water? Do I want tea? Do I want coffee? Oh, now I've got too much choice, but I can't make a decision. It's overwhelmed. There's too much to choose from. And so that causes stress and emotion problems. Anyway, so, so if I want a cup of tea, I've made the decision. I want a cup of tea. Now what do I need to do? What's the first step? Literally the first step. I need to go and find the water that will provide the tea. I need to find a kettle. I now need to put water in the kettle. I now need to find a teacup. And I had to do all of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, like whether we're learning to drive a car for the first time or whatever, everything. And going from being an officer and my memory of leading well 164 soldiers and knowing that my whole future was going to be in the army to then not having the ability to be able to make a cup of tea, but knowing I used to be able to.
How was your speech and reading ability affected?
I don't have any memories of it being a problem. Speech was a problem, not in my ability to speak, but my ability to, I lost the understanding of what, of nuances, of the subtleties of words, of people, of being able to read faces, of being able to be intuitive about what they were perhaps meaning or saying. It was literally take everything literally.
Yeah.
Every single word. So there was no, you know, so I lost any, you couldn't suggest something to me.
No.
So if you told me to, no, I'm trying to think of an example. I can't. So I had a lot of speech language therapy. It's a rigidity in thinking is another problem. And so I would have a thought in my head and it would become the most important thought in my head, irrespective of whatever else was going on. And I could not focus or concentrate until I had asked that question or said it. And it just overruled everything.
Were you aware at the time that was going to be a bit of an issue? Or is it sort of looking back or over a period of time you've realised?
It's being in the moment. It's not knowing it at the time. You just lose self-awareness.
Yeah.
And you just lose your, lose what? You lose your source of measurement of how to measure. Am I being sociable? Am I being pleasant? It's the hardest thing I can ever describe.
And how long did it take to get back to being able to make a cup of tea, for example, and not have to think too much about it?
The fact of being able to make a cup of tea probably took me a couple of months.
Yeah.
But the ability to make a cup of tea around other people, or if the radio is on, or if there are other distractions, where I couldn't cope with that for a long time, maybe for a year or so. So, you know, if we think about it, it's every sense is always alert. We receive information through every sense. So I've got a sort of almost a cognitive overload of information, of external sensory information and internal cognitive processes where the brain is. So it's, I don't know, I'm a Ferrari with the engine of a Fiat Panda. I'm a MacBook Pro with a processing chip of a Commodore 64.
Yeah.
I've got so many of these pathways are working, but so many are not. And they can't talk to each other. So the brain has to learn how to reconfigure, reorganize, rebuild. But it will only rebuild and reorganize if you put the effort into it. If you make if you're persistent in trying to do something to build up a new a new skill or whatever it is. You know, it's a neuroplasticity. Unless we do something persistently and consistently, we won't grow. It's about turning our states into neural traits, and that requires effort.
And that's something that you're still working with and contending with, is it, Stuart?
Very much so. So real life example. So I've been on here and I've been talking for far too long. But this in itself, this is the major being on this podcast now has been the big thing in my life for the last 2 weeks. I was supposed to do last week, as you know, but I've been poorly, so I couldn't do it. But this is the biggest thing in my diary this week.
Well, I really, really appreciate that.
Being able to talk like this. So I would not have been able to do this 5-6 years ago, or or however many years ago. So everything in my going, catching a bus on my, everything is just more effortful.
What made you decide to use that experience to help others?
I think two things. One is through my experience of being an officer and a leader. That's still there. This feel that it's the responsibility of leadership, the honor of leading at Santos as a motto called "Serve to Lead." You know, it's an honor to be able to be in a position where we can influence and help people to grow and reach their potential. So that's the best thing I loved about being in the army, was helping soldiers reach their potential for those who wanted to. I saw soldiers arrive from very dysfunctional, really hard backgrounds, tough backgrounds, who had no support, but they had left the military after however many years with confidence and security. Saw soldiers arrive with no education, no schooling, and leave with master's degree. Wow. Seen soldiers arrive with nothing and leave with everything. And that is so beautiful, empowering, transformational for me. I love that. So I've always loved that aspect of it. And I want to make people's lives better. Trying to find a way to do that now is incredibly hard. So the sort of the speaking bit came about, that just evolved. So this is the second aspect. So the one is it's something I've always loved about the army. And the second one is, how can I do that? Well, the way that I've fallen into evolved is through speaking engagements. Yes. And that was because I was doing a lot of stuff with military charities, both for my own recovery. But then because I could talk fairly well and articulate the power and the influence that the charities had on us and on our recovery, I was often asked to be the spokesperson. And then there just happened to be a member of the audience who was the CEO of Lockheed Martin, who said, "Oh, Stuart, you talk fairly well. coming to give a talk to my company, and we'll pay you." It's like, "Oh, okay, an income. Yeah. Okay, yeah. I'd love to." And then so it came from that. And so that's what I've been doing with other stuff. I'm a part-time artist, part-time speaker, part-time house husband. All of that together is a lot of work.
Yes.
And I'm just trying to be the best I can in those three areas. I could be better. I could be more coordinated. I could plan and organize my life better. But I'm just doing the best I can to make my own life better. And I love, in whatever way I can, making other people's lives better.
And when you do your talks, Stuart, what sort of themes and subjects do you cover?
Well, I've developed two key talks. One is on resilience, and one is on leadership, coherent leadership. So my resilience one is a formula that it's the three pillars of resilience. R equals MPG squared. So resilience is about minimizing negative thoughts, the M. It's about pursuing positive neuroplasticity, which is the P. And it's about generating collective strength, which is a G, but this is squared because social support and the support of others is the force multiplier in everything that we do. So one of my talks is R equals MPG squared, or whatever title I determine, but it's about resilience. And then the other one is about coherent leadership, my style of leadership, which is about where our words and our actions and values are aligned. This is about aligning, inspiring, and guiding the execution of our goals as a leader.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's about engagement with individuals, engagements with teams. And so they're the sort of the two main talks that I give.
With what you've learned, what could anybody listening who perhaps feels that they might not be motivated enough or there's something lacking in their life, what advice would you give them?
Okay, I will throw out three very quick acronyms, but I won't give them any description. Honestly, the for building up resilience. Resilience is not just about protecting yourself; it's also about life expansion and growing. Minimize negative thoughts. Identify the damaging ones. Find ways that you can minimize them because they can be so destructive. Pursue positive neuroplasticity about the internalization and consolidation of our positive thoughts, emotional experiences, and get support, social support. So there's R equals MPG squared is one. Another one that I use is that I haven't developed as a talk, but I've got an idea of a potential book, but that's a long way down the line, is what I call steps. So steps to building potential, steps to your potential. I'm not sure what I'm going to use for, but it's basically the S is self-awareness. You've got to understand yourself. You've got to understand your strengths and your weaknesses and what holds you back.
Yep.
The T is target positive neuroplasticity. You know, it's turning our beneficial states into traits, becoming the person we want to be, which requires effort and persistence. The E is embracing our strengths because then it becomes effortless. It becomes more energizing. We're reaching optimum functioning of our brain. The P is purposeful living, which we haven't gone into, but that fuels you and can get you through such hard times. And then the S is social support. I keep coming back to social support. So steps to that. And then the other one, which I call settle. Yeah. Settle the brain, S-E-T-T-L-E. So whenever you're making any decisions, when you're thinking about things, whether they're grand ideas, whether the future, the big events, or just, you know, everyday minutiae of life, always consider the survival part of the brain, the emotional and the cognitive part, three level engagement. So S, survival, emotional, thinking, three level engagement. Because we should use all of our brain. The brain's incredibly powerful. I did not realize how powerful it is. It can be so incredibly destructive, or it can be so incredibly energizing and fulfilling and stimulating and exhilarating. And we all have that ability in us. But it requires thought, it requires self-awareness, and it requires a determination. Life is about the smallest of steps. To build neural pathways, it takes small, sustainable steps, everyday steps of improvement. That is, I am still building slowly my neural pathways. It's been 12, 13, 14 years since my injury, but yeah. I'm so much better than when I was before. Yeah. And then the one thing, because I know it's a question you're going to ask, what is one thing that people can take away? And I ask this question to you, and you don't need to answer it. If you knew that you were going to die tomorrow or in 1 hour's time, what is the one or couple of things that you would have regretted not doing in your life?
That's a very...
That is the one thing to consider. So I did that because I've contemplated my life a lot because I've been suicidal. I've been in despair. I considered perhaps my life too much. But anyway, I thought, okay, Stu, I know I'm going to die. I'm 95. I'm 100. What would I regret not doing? Two things straight away jumped out. Never learning to play the piano.
Oh, right.
And never going to Australia to watch the British Lions. I've been now learning to play the piano for 6 years, and I absolutely love it. And my goal is to get to at least grade 8 before I leave this world. And then I'm going to watch the British Lions in 2 years' time to Australia.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I don't know how I'm going to pay for it. My wife doesn't know how I'm going to pay for it, but I'm going to find a way.
But they were the two things that came up. So as listeners, we need to do that. We need to think a bit more about that, I guess.
Yes, because we've only got one bloody chance at this life.
Yeah.
And so much of this is basic, and it's been spoken about by Aristotle, by Socrates, by Viktor Frankl, by Hertzberg, by, you know, all of these names I can drop, and the modern philosophers and psychologists. It all comes back to the same thing all the time, which is about positive and negative affect, which is about purpose, which is about small sustainable actions, small improvements, whether, you know, whether we call it the David Brailsford, was it marginal gains, the how can I make my boat go faster, the minimum effective dose. This is about maximizing our potential of the brain. Study the brain, look at the brain, look at neurochemistry, neuroscience. Honestly, it's just unbelievable what the brain can do.
Well, thank you for that. Stuart, thank you ever so much for coming on. And I really appreciate the effort that you've taken to come on the show. And I know, it, you know, you mentioned about, you know, for 2 weeks you've been thinking about it and you've had to prepare yourself for it. So I really appreciate that. It's been a moving conversation, but it's been very uplifting as well with some of those things that you've been saying, which I think I've certainly taken away from, and I think listeners will too. So thank you ever so much for coming on the show, Stuart.
No problems. If you want to, just go on LinkedIn, please. Stuart Hill, Making Lives Better. Search me out. Ask me a question. I'm happy to talk to anyone if they're struggling or suffering. I honestly don't mind at all.
Well, that's fantastic, Stuart. And I'll put that link on the show notes for anybody that listens. Thanks very much.
Also, put my website on there.
Yes, I'll put the website as well. I'll put your link on there. Yeah, that's great. Thank you very much. Been listening to Undercurrent Stories. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please feel free to share the show link to your friends and family, and if you have 60 seconds, I will be most grateful if you would please rate and review. To hear more episodes, please subscribe to the show and visit undercurrentstories.com. If you leave your email in the link, we will notify you as soon as new episodes are released. Also, check out our social media links, details of which can be found on the show notes. Until next time, this is Bob Wells wishing you all the very best.